Don't look now.
Welcome to Don't Look Now, the podcast with your hosts, J.D. McDonald and Will Higgeman, coming to you every Tuesday, which should be today as we are releasing this, with our random tales of, you know, history, mystery, cats, cookies, whatever we might be talking about today. Something tells me, it being close to Halloween, we can just about bet on something vaguely spooky, I'm willing to bet, out of Jenny. But I never know, because I am not the keeper of the topic. That is Jenny, who has been doing our research. Who knows what we're going to talk about? I have no idea. So give me some clues here.
I got an idea
that it's probably going to be spooky, because, you know, hey, Halloween, Jenny, they go together. But specifics, I don't know. So give me some clues here.
Part two to last week.
Oh, yeah, well, duh. Okay, I actually know this one, you know. I have this crazy feeling that it's going to have something to do with Jack the Ripper. That's what we're going to be talking about today.
There you go.
Yeah. I forgot that was a two-parter. So, yes. Yeah. More Jack the Ripper. Actually, more Jack the Ripper himself, as opposed to basically the victims and their backgrounds from last time. So right. All right. So lead us off now that I remember what we're talking about here.
Yeah, to be fair.
Tell how much I remember from last week.
We were okay. Toast last week. It's fine.
All right. So cool. Well, so there we go. So yeah.
Yeah. So we'll pick up at the investigation of the murders. So basically there's a bunch of murders that are happening in the area nearby in Whitechapel and in a couple of the boroughs. And there's like 30 murders that have happened, but we only have five that are like the true canonical five.
Mm-hmm.
But there's several that are questionable, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So the vast majority of the City of London police files relating to the investigation in the Whitechapel murders was actually destroyed during the Blitz.
Hmm.
Thanks a lot, World Wars.
Yeah.
Damn. But the surviving files that they did have, which, honest to God, the fact that they had any files that survived and someone took the time to go figure out who's went where and with what is pretty phenomenal. But they had a detailed view of investigative procedures from this Victorian era. So we know that a large team of policemen conducted house-to-house inquiries throughout Whitechapel. Forensic material was collected and examined. Victorian era forensics material, mind you, right?
I was going to say, that's pretty different looking than now. That...
Just a little. They had suspects who were identified, and then they traced them. And there's like different levels of inquiry, of course, when you look at suspects. There's the ones that are an immediate, like, yeah, there's no way it's this guy. Then there's the ones that you're like, I don't really have any evidence that says they're not, but I'm not really like feeling this one.
Mm-hmm.
There's the ones, and with this, since it's never been solved, there's the ones that are like, whoo, this is a strong, weird suspect. Strong, weird one.
Yeah.
So modern police work pretty much follows this same pattern in identifying and eliminating suspects. But what we know is that more than 2,000 people were interviewed regarding the murders. Now,
wow.
This is for the whole kit and caboodle of the 20, not just the five, right?
Yeah.
300 were deeply investigated, which is pretty impressive. And 80 were detained at various points in time, believing that they were the one.
Wow.
Yeah. So this is similar to like the Golden State Killer. I believe they had a ton of people that they detained at various points in time, and that they couldn't be this person. And then it was one of, you know, like an off chance person.
Mm-hmm.
So following the murders of Catherine Eddowes and I cannot remember her first name, Stride. The commissioner of the city police offers a reward for £500 for the arrest of the Ripper, which at that time's hell of a lot of money.
Yeah.
Especially in this impoverished region. So initially, the investigation is conducted by the Metro Police in Whitechapel, and it's headed by Detective Inspector Edmund Reed. But after the murder of Catherine Nichols, Detective Inspector Frederick Aberline, Henry Moore, and Walter Andrews were sent from the central office at Scotland Yard to help assist, because they were like, hey, things are getting worse, not better. Maybe we should lean in, right?
Yeah.
So City of London police were involved under Detective Inspector James McWilliams after the Eddowes murder, which occurred within the City of London. There were issues, though, with a lot of the inquiry, because the head of the Criminal Investigations Department was on leave during the period of time of September 7th and October 6th, which is when three of the canonical five were killed. So he's on vacation. So they had a hard time doing some of that forensic investigation that needs to be done in a murder case, right?
Yeah.
So they appointed someone from Scotland Yard to do the inquiry. And that is Chief Inspector Donald Swanson. So those are the people that are doing the investigation. Now here's what they look at. So they look at the murders themselves and they think, what kind of skill set would one need to perform these rather intricate mutilations? And immediately, of course, they suspect butchers, slaughterers, surgeons, and physicians. Basically, anybody that would have wielded a knife that went into things because of the way that the mutilations were done. There was a note that survived the Blitz from Major Henry Smith, who was the commissioner of the city of police, indicated that the alibis of local butchers and slaughterers were investigated. And anybody that they could get an alibi for, they immediately like removed them from the inquiry. So they confirmed that 76 butchers and slaughterers were visited. And that was everybody that had been employed for the previous 6 months prior to the murder, basically, in those positions in that area.
Okay.
Queen Victoria thought that the pattern of the murders indicated the culprit was a butcher or cattle drover of one of the cattle boats that plied between London and mainland Europe. Whitechapel was close to the docks, so it's possible, especially since the boats docked on a Thursday or Friday and left on a Saturday or Sunday. Unfortunately, though, none of the cattle boats that they examined coincided with movements. So, like, and none of the transfer of, like, cruise people or anything did. So that was easily tossed out. But what an interesting theory from the queen of the country. Good for her, right?
Yeah.
So, in September of 1888, a group of volunteer citizens in London's East End formed the Whitechapel Vigilance Committee. And by vigilance, I mean vigilantes. So they took it
East
upon
End
themselves.
East End Batman Club. All right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's yeah, West End right. Batman. East End. Sorry. So they patrol the streets looking for suspicious characters, mostly because they're dissatisfied with the police and also, you know, rioting during this time really wouldn't have been a big surprise to anybody because everybody was on edge at all times, which having a bunch of people then roaming the streets looking for a murderer doesn't really help. Just going to put that out there. Right.
Yep.
And one of the things that they were really worried about is local businessmen were the like prime people to join this vigilante group because they were concerned the murders were affecting their business in the area. So the government starts to feel the crunch of like, okay, we need to do something about this. So the committee petitioned the government to raise the reward for information leading to the arrest of the killer. And they had raised £50 of their own. So the original amount is £5,000, which now is the equivalent of like $100,000.
Yeah.
Because this £50 is the equivalent of somewhere between £6,000 and £90,000. So it raises quickly, depending on what part of the year you're looking at, right? And they also hired private detectives to question people independently because they didn't trust the questioning of the police. So the same people that got questioned by the cops were now being questioned by all these private detectives. So at the end of October, Robert Anderson asked police surgeon Thomas Bond to give his opinion on the extent of the murderer's surgical skills and knowledge. He's like, so we think it's a surgeon or a butcher. So tell us what you think is going on. And he's like, well, here's my opinion. If we look at the earliest surviving offender profile, right? So he had examined the most extensively mutilated victim and the postmortem from the previous murders. all five murders were probably committed by the same guy, because they looked at similar traits of the attacks. So you've got a throat slashing from left to right. Uncertain what the fatal slash was, but that was a common thing to happen. And the circumstances surrounding, he allowed him to form the opinion that women were probably laying down when they were murdered. So face down and neck pull back situation because of the arterial spray, which is gross, right? He was strongly opposed to the idea that the murderer possessed any kind of specific scientific or anatomical knowledge or even technical knowledge to be a butcher or horse slaughterer. In his opinion, he was like, nah, that is not what we're looking at here. We're probably looking at a very solitary person who was subject to periodical attacks of homicidal and erotic mania. With the character of the mutilations probably indicating a specific ailment. He also stated that the homicidal impulse was probably developed from revengeful or brooding condition of the mind or a religious mania that is part of this like diagnostic mental health issue. He's like, but it's not likely either that it's due to those two, the religious mania or this mental health condition. There's also no evidence that the perpetrator engaged in any sexual activity with the victims, yet psychologists suppose that the penetration of the victims with the knife and leaving them in these degrading positions with wounds exposed probably is. I would probably state that also because he attacks their sex organs, that probably would be a sexually motivated crime. That seems very intimate, but I'm also not a psychologist. And some people, you know, agree with me on that, by the way, just for the record. Yeah. In addition, you've got a ton of contradictions. There's a ton of unreliability. We've got really weird contemporaneous accounts. Anything that they've done to identify the murderers hampered by the lack of surviving forensic evidence because of the Blitz. They tried to do DNA analysis on like letters that were sent around the time to the newspaper because there are letters. But they're too contaminated. And at this point, if you don't even have a comparison sample, what do you do, right?
Yeah.
So, unknown. There have been mutually incompatible claims that the DNA evidence that does exist points to two completely different suspects. A Whitechapel barber by the name of Aaron Kaminsky and an artist by the name of Walter Sickert, who is the one that Patricia Cornwell fingers in her book as the culprit. The scientific methodology, though, to do this has been criticized heavily.
Okay.
Also, her book is fascinatingly weird. Like, if you want to get in deep psychology of somebody, it's weird. So we know the concentration of the killings happens around the weekends and public holidays. They're within a pretty short distance of one another. So this indicates to a lot of people that Jack the Ripper is in regular employment and lives locally. It's possible, and this is one of the theories, because remember, this has been 100 and some years, so there are bat crap theories out there about this at this point. So you have some people that think that he's an educated upper-class man who ventured into Whitechapel from a better, well-to-do area, which also kind of matches with like the appearance, because people talk about how he didn't look poor. He looked like, you know, he had a nice overcoat and stuff like that. So maybe these theories draw on cultural perceptions such as fear of the medical profession, mistrust of modern medicine, exploitation of the poor by the rich. So this is when people start to really look into this kind of stuff. And is this a work of fiction? Is it reality? And, you know, like, you have these doctors were not all trained honorably.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about the body snatcher people, right?
Mm-hmm.
That would have happened. What, snatchers? I'm Googling because I can't remember the date off the top of my head, but Burke and Hare. What, when was that? I want to say it was around, it's around the same time. So it's 18, it's like 50 years earlier.
Yeah.
So that's in the cultural memory of people stealing bodies to give to doctors to train on. So it doesn't embed the most trust
Yeah.
in the public of the medical profession. And you've got a bunch of different theories about the actual identity and profession of him, but no one agrees on any of them. And a number of the named suspects, like I said, we have hundreds of the suspects, so who knows? But something very interesting is over the course of the Whitechapel murders, the police, newspaper, and other individuals received hundreds of letters about the case, which isn't unusual, really, in a time period where, like, mail would have been prolific anyway. So, like, a bunch of them were just well-intended offers of advice on how to catch him. Some of them were hoaxes, and some of them were just, like, useless information. Because, remember, money's associated if you give good tips, right? And hundreds of the letters we do know were claimed to have been written by the killer himself. There's three of them that seem rather promising. So this story kind of likes to have those, the canonical five, the three letter, you know, very, very strict in this ripperology, if you will. So we've got the Dear Boss letter, the Saucy Jackie, and From Hell. And the From Hell, there's a movie even that they use the title. Yeah. So Dear Boss is the letter dated September 25th. It was postmarked on the 27th of 1888. And it was received by the Central News Agency. And they were like, this feels weird. We're going to take this to Scotland Yard because this seems legit.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that like newspapers have a pretty good filter system, even during this time period, of cutting through the bullshit. So initially it's considered a hoax, but when they found Catherine Eddowes 3 days after the postmark with part of her ear missing, the promise of the author to clip a lady's ear off gained the attention of the newspaper. And they were like, oh, they did what this letter said. That's a little creepy.
Yeah.
That's a coincidence too much, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they send that to Scotland Yard and they're like, this is not cool. And they, you know, her ear does appear to have been nicked by the killer incidentally during the attack. But the other note is that the letter writer threatened to send the ears to the police, but never did. But the fact that it was so similar was what was so weird about it, which is why it flags in things. The name Jack the Ripper was first used in this letter by the signatory and gained worldwide notoriety, of course, almost immediately. Remember, this is around the time of H.H. Holmes and the World Fair in Chicago. So information was spreading very quickly about this. And then a lot of the other letters that followed copied the tone of that Dear Boss letter. Some authors adopted pseudonyms such as George of the High Rip Gang or Jack Sheridan the Ripper. Some sources claim that another letter dated 17 of September was the first to use the name Jack the Ripper. But most people thought that was mistakenly fake. It's a fake. They salted the records that were recovered from the Blitz, they think. So the From Hell letter, or I'm sorry, the Saucy Jack letter came next. Saucy Jack postcard was postmarked on the 1st of October, received the same day by Central News Agency. The handwriting was pretty similar to that Dear Boss letter, so it was another red flag. And it mentioned the canonical murders committed on the 30th of September, to which the author refers to by writing the double event this time. So this is the night that the two women were killed very closely together. And it's been argued that the postcard was posted before the murders were actually publicized. So it would have had, because of the quick speed at which it arrived, right? So that was the thing that made them go, oh, this is probably not a hoax. Like, this is too quick. People wouldn't know this yet. But it was 24 hours after the murders, so who knows, you know, it's a small area.
Yeah.
And then we have the From Hell letter. And it reads, From Hell, Mr. Lusk, sir, I send you half the kidney I took from one woman, preserved it for you to t'other piece. I fried and ate it. It was real nice. I may send you the bloody knife that I took out if you only wait a while longer. Signed, catch me when you can, Mr. Lusk. Now, this is spelled horribly, so that's why I struggle. But this letter is received by George Lusk, who is the leader of the Whitechapel Vigilance Committee, on the 16th of October. The handwriting and style doesn't match the other two letters. The letter came with a small box in which he discovered half a human kidney, preserved in spirits of wine. Ethanol. Straight ethanol. And we do know that Catherine Eddowes' left kidney had been removed by the killer. The writer claimed that he ate part of it. Cannibalism.
Yeah.
Just a little bit. We have to demonize it, though, some more, right? So even if it's not true, we got to make it seem true.
Yeah.
And there is quite a bit of a disagreement over the fact that some people don't believe it belonged to her, and we didn't have DNA testing at the time to even match blood types, right? Like,
yeah.
Does it match? Don't know. What we do know is the kidney was examined by Thomas Openshaw of the London Hospital. He said, yeah, it's human. It's from the left side. But other than that, no idea. None. So Scotland Yard publishes parts of the Dear Boss letter and the postcard on October 3rd in a pretty vain attempt that a member of the public would look at it and be like, oh my God, I know whose handwriting that is. That's my cousin Steve, right? Like,
yeah.
Maybe something. Oh man, please don't. Karma. I get it. Sorry, my windows are open. So they thought that this would be super easy. You just put it out there, we'll crowdsource, somebody will recognize this handwriting. Charles Warren explained in a letter to Godfrey Lushington, who's the Undersecretary of State for the Home Department. He said, I think the whole thing's a hoax, but of course, we have to try to find who the writer is in any case. So even if this isn't the guy that killed everybody, we still want to figure out who the writer is because it's still pretty gross, right?
Yeah.
And then in October 7th of 1888, the Sunday newspaper, The Referee, implies scathingly, the letter is actually written by a journalist. They were like, we think that a journalist did this so that they could increase their circulation over at that other newspaper, the one that shall not be named, right?
Mm-hmm.
And police officials later claimed to have identified, actually, a specific journalist as potentially the author of the Dear Boss and the postcard. The journalist was identified as Tom Bolin in a letter from the chief inspector. Chief Inspector John Littlechild to George R. Sims, dated in 23rd of September, 1913. He says a journalist named Fred Best reportedly confessed in 1931 that he and a colleague actually had written the letters at the Star. And Jack the Ripper just kind of kept business alive.
Yeah.
So they kept on pushing the story. You know, it was a slow media cycle then. They had to keep things spicy. Otherwise, people wouldn't pay the penny for their penny dreadfuls, right?
Yeah.
So these murders are important to the treatment of crime by journalists. Because Jack the Ripper is not the first serial killer. But he is the first one that worldwide became a frenzy of media information.
Mm-hmm.
In 1880, the Elementary Education Act made a school attendance compulsory regardless of class. So at this point in time, we have probably the most working class people who are literate in England and Wales than ever before. So everybody was reading these papers. It was sensationalized, right?
Yeah.
And then we have tax reforms in the 1850s that had enabled the publication of really expensive newspapers with really wide circulation, so everybody could get their hands onto them. These mushroomed into the later Victorian era to include mass circulation newspapers that cost as little as half a penny, along with the Illustrated Police News, which made the Ripper the beneficiary of unparalleled publicity. There are more comics and crap devoted to this. It's phenomenal. And of course, like when I say comics, they're not like, ha ha, funny people died. They're like mocking the police officers doing a shitty job catching Jack the Ripper.
Yeah.
And Jack the Ripper taunting them, kind of, are the themes of a lot of them. So the height of the investigation, we know over 1 million copies of newspapers with extensive coverage devoted to the Whitechapel murders were sold each day.
Hmm.
Not just like a year. Each day, a million papers were sold. Most of the articles are bullshit. They're totally like sensationalistic, speculative, full of false information. And the false information is presented as fact. So, like, this is where we run into a lot of issue with ripperologists. is, you know, we're so used to using newspapers as sources.
Yeah.
You can't. And several of the articles, of course, speculate the identity of the Ripper. And remember, we talked about a lot of like xenophobic issues happening in the area at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So they played on that just real hard in these publications. So in the early September days, a few days after the murder of Marianne Nichols, the Manchester Guardian reported whatever information may be in the possession of the police, they deem it necessary to keep it a secret. I can't imagine why. It's believed their attention is particularly directed to a notorious character known as Leather Apron.
Leather Apron, huh?
And so, like, journalists are frustrated because the cops aren't sharing anything. So they just start writing shit to write shit. Because they're like, if you're not going to tell us, we're going to make it up and it's going to be so good. It's going to be better than the actual story, right? So we have these really imaginative descriptions of Leather Apron that start to appear. And then rival journalists dismiss them as mythical outgrowth. They're fancy. And, you know, whatever you can do to harass the general public. So one of the suspects that these newspapers pulled out of thin air is a local Jewish man who made footwear from leather. His name's John Pizer, and he's known as the name Leather Apron. He actually gets arrested, but there's no evidence, so he's released because he has alibis. But, you know, they stirred up enough of a fuss to get people frustrated enough to arrest him.
Yeah.
And then after the publication of the letter and Jack the Ripper being put in the forefront of knowledge, we lose that Leather Apron association. And they start to describe the killer. The name Jack was already in use to describe another London attacker called Spring-Heeled Jack. And he supposedly leapt over walls to strike at his victims and then disappeared as quickly as he appeared. So the invention and adoption of a nickname for a particular killer, that's pretty standard in media practice. That's like even still pretty common. Golden yeah. State Killer, Beltway Killer, you know. And it was pretty standard at that time, too, because around this time period, we're looking at like the Axemen of New Orleans, the Boston Strangler, the Camden Ripper, the Blackout Ripper, all these things, Yorkshire Rippers. Rippers became very common. Very common.
Yeah.
And the fact that no one ever is convicted, it just adds to this mystery, right?
Yeah.
So we know that the nature of Jack the Ripper murders and the impoverished lifestyle of the victims drew a lot of attention to the East End and how crappy the living conditions were there. It really pulled together the public in a weird way because they started to form this really strong opinion about how overcrowded the slums were and how unsanitary they are. So, like, 20 years after the murders, the worst of the slums at this point have been completely cleared out and demolished. A few of the streets and some of the buildings survive, but, like, creepy people like me, and I would be the first to admit, I would go on the tour. I would.
Yeah.
I would go on the tour because I want to understand the range in real time.
Yeah.
And I'm sick like that, and I apologize. But, like, you can still go on the tours and find out other information about the cases in person where things really took place. For a lot of long time, the Ten Bells Public House on Commercial Street was the focus of the tours. If it's anything like tours in any other city in Europe you've been to, there's usually, like, a person standing out on the street corner. You give them 10 pounds and you just, like, follow a person and hope you don't get murdered yourself. I did some really cool tours like that in Scotland. So
nice.
Yeah. Where you go down into like catacombs with strangers and then graveyards. Yeah. This seems safe, right?
Yeah. No problem.
Yeah. It was great. So in the immediate aftermath of the murders and later, Jack the Ripper's totally a boogeyman. This is the story you told your kids. They told the most monstrous versions of it, of course. By the time the 1920s and 30s had rolled around, he's appearing in film, dressed in everyday clothes. He was a man with a secret. He preyed on unsuspecting victims. By the 60s, he'd become the symbol of a predatory aristocracy. and was always portrayed as a gentleman with a top hat.
Yeah.
And that was an interesting period of time where that was very like symbolic of a lot of horror films. There was a whole period of time in horror where upper class exploitation was taking place. So like, who could afford to be creepy that long? Rich people. But it basically boils down to. At any rate, we know that there are hundreds of books, movies, poems, comic books, games, operas, even nonfiction books devoted to Jack the Ripper. And that the term Ripperology was coined in the 70s by Colin Wilson. And that's used by both professionals and amateurs to describe the Jack the Ripper work.
Yeah.
Like I said, I personally think it's an interesting story. So I think we should talk about some of the interesting famous suspects.
Yeah. Well, don't sounds you? Good to me. Sounds like a plan.
So let's throw ourselves down a rabbit hole. First up, Lewis Carroll. Seems like the perfect Jack the Ripper, right?
Previous podcast subject.
Yeah. So there is a book from 1996 called Jack the Ripper, Lighthearted Friend. That's the title, Jack the Ripper, Lighthearted Friend.
All right, that book's already pretty sus. But yeah.
Yes. But the author, Richard Wallace, alleges that Lewis Carroll or Charles L. Dodgson committed the murders. According to Wallace, Carroll had confessed in the form of anagrams within his correspondence and literary works, including The Nursery Alice as a young child's version of his most notable work, Alice in Wonderland. In theory, yes, in theory, Lewis Carroll would have been alive during the time and in proximity in which one could take the train from Oxford to London and commit the murders. There is no other evidence that exists except for some guy's ability to dig into works and pull out some shit out of his ass.
He was alive, he existed, and he lived in the southern half of the UK. So you're good. Yeah.
Right? Yeah, yep. Perfect. Easy enough. No. Up next, H.H. Holmes.
Oh, there you go. That's always a series. Popular one these days. He kind of has blown up as the now solution to every famous.
Oh, yeah.
You know, murder case ever. I mean, I think he came up when we were talking about the Axemen of New Orleans as well. So.
Exactly. So the theory is actually a little bit tighter. So he was in London. H.H. Holmes was in London during this time.
Mm-hmm.
His handwriting is very similar to the handwriting from the letter sent to the Ripper police, if you believe to the police investigating the Ripper murder, if you believe that those are Ripper letters.
Mm-hmm.
And then descriptions are similar. Like if you did a police sketch at the time versus a picture of him, very similar. Mm-hmm. Do I believe it? Absolutely not. Do I think H.H. Holmes was a murderer? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Do I think he's Jack the Ripper? Absolutely not. I think he was following Jack the Ripper. But yeah. I don't think he was Jack the Ripper. Sorry. Not that one. Up next. This is when it starts to get into some gossipy Europeans.
Yes, I can imagine.
Lord Randolph Churchill, son. His son becomes, well, his son is, sorry. I don't know how to say this one.
The dad possibly. Of Winston Churchill. There you go.
Yes, his son is Winston Churchill. Thank you. So yeah, the theory is that Churchill is the head of the group of Masons conspiring to kill sex workers that were blackmailing a member of the royal family. One supposed piece of evidence is an extraordinarily detailed description of a man seen with Mary Kelly, the last of the canonical five, shortly before her death. The suspect is described as well-dressed, with his attire accessorized with a gold watch chain. He's 5'6" tall, with dark hair and a mustache. Yeah, he looks like that. so do a lot of other men, but also, we were demonizing these women. They were not sex workers, so. No. Just no. Not that one. Next up, Dr. Thomas Cream. He is a serial killer who is active in London in 1892. He's known as the Lambeth Poisoner, which is interesting because, like, poison's not usually the men's choice. That's usually a woman's way to murder.
It's a totally different MO. Yeah.
Yeah. And it is a totally different MO. So it's very odd. But he is believed to have poisoned at least 10 people in 3 countries and is executed for it. His last words were supposedly, "I am Jack," just as the trap door to the gallows opened. Did his handwriting look similar? Yes. But here's the kicker. He was in jail when Jack the Ripper was murdering people in Illinois.
That would be quite the alibi.
Right. So, probably not him. This one's one of my favorite ones, though. Prince Albert.
Yep. That's the one that I always hear, yeah.
Yeah. This one's one of the most amazing. It's grandson. It's a grandson. Maybe. There are several theories that an heir to the British throne is responsible for the Ripper murders. One originates in 1970, published by a doctor that details his friendship with the family of the royal physician. The author, Dr. Thomas Stowell, seemed to heavily imply, without naming any names, that Prince Albert Victor, Queen Victoria's grandson, had contracted syphilis. At the time, his death was attributed to influenza. But honestly, this theory is probably one that makes a little bit of sense, and that the syphilis, they say, made him crazy. Mm-hmm. And he murdered several ladies of the evening in retribution, because he also probably got it from the ladies, right?
Yeah.
Another theory alleges that the prince married a Whitechapel woman and had a secret baby, and that the women that were murdered were actually potential witnesses to that, which also makes sense because it's in a small enough radius that, like, oh, someone saw them together, right?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there's a problem with this theory too. Damn it. He was not in town when a bunch of the murders occurred, so it's probably not him.
Yeah.
I do love a good syphilis made me go crazy story, though, so I will find more of those.
Need more crazed syphilitic grandchildren of Queen Victoria.
You know, syphilis is such an interesting disease, and so many more people have it than we realize.
Yeah.
That, like, I bet it accounts for a lot more impulsive and odd behavior than we really give it credit for.
Well, a lot of famous people that had it. I mean, you got Al Capone and all kinds of people that.
Exactly. Then we have James Maybrick. So in London in 1889, Florence Maybrick is convicted of poisoning her husband, James, and sentenced to death. This is commuted. She was actually released about 6 years later, which is interesting, right? Yeah. And about a century later, a really interesting diary comes to light. So the diarist does not give their name, but it's presumed to be James Maybrick, the husband. And it details the canonical 5 murders. A man named Michael Barrett presented the diary publicly after he said it was given to him by a family friend. Later, he said it was a forgery. Then he recanted it. But people still really believe this diary, right?
Yeah.
So if it's not him, who could it be? Maybe it's his brother, Michael Maybrick. So he's one of the most famous singer and songwriters of the day. I can't imagine what that looks like during this time period. I'm sorry. I don't know if that means, like, you're a bard, like you still going to court. I don't, or they just play, like, I am picturing the guy from The Witcher in my head when I say this, because I have no context for what this looks like in the 1800s.
I'm assuming 1880s, you got phonographs and whatnot by then. So, you know,
it's true. So he's famous. He works under the name of Stephen Adams. And a writer-director, Bruce Robinson, alleges that he loathes his sister-in-law so much that he committed the murders to frame his brother that she murdered. And he further suggests that evidence linking him as a Freemason to the crime was destroyed by the police, which feeds then into the, like, whole conspiracy theory that the Ripper killed his victims as part of the Masonic ritual, which is then protected by the organization, which then has people back in Victorian England in high places, which makes me think that he's part of the Victorian court and he is a bard that goes and plays in bars. And it has nothing to do with what it really looked like in the 1800s. Probably not him. So let's talk about the Patricia Cornwall guy, Walter Sickert. He's a Victorian era painter, and his paintings are dark, my man. They are sad and bummery. He claims to have lived in the Ripper's former home, even titled one of his paintings Jack the Ripper's Bedroom. So why wouldn't you jump on this, right?
Yeah.
It seems like a theory that lends itself to truth. So Patricia Cornwall buys dozens of his paintings to prove he's not just a contemporary, but the actual murderer himself. And like I said, I read the book. I read it when I was working at the engineering department, actually.
Yeah.
It's interesting. But in her book, she says the paintings demonstrate violence and misogyny, and draws together some really weird circumstantial forensic evidence to make this case that's not that particularly compelling. A real loose case. And it's even contradictory in the book, because she talks about his alibi. He's in France during two of the murders. Probably not him. How about a theory that's a little different? What if it's not a man?
Well, there you go. It's at least different.
Yeah, it's different.
It's Jill the Ripper. We got it.
Exactly. That actually is exactly what they call her, is Jill the Ripper.
It just lends itself to instant name.
Or the Mad Midwife is the other one.
Okay.
So the idea in this one being, maybe the killings demonstrated a knowledge of anatomy, the kind that a woman who delivered babies might know, particularly the kind of lady that might be performing a back alley abortion. Also, a woman walking around with bloodstained clothes in the night would not be considered suspicious as a midwife.
Yeah.
However, this one's not treated as super credible by most people, which I kind of appreciate. I think that level of mutilation lends to some anger that probably a midwife wasn't feeling, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Not a midwife. So finally, Aaron Kaminsky. I'm only giving you 10. I'm not giving you all 800.
Yeah.
One of the few remaining pieces of evidence from the Ripper case is a shawl that belonged to Catherine Eddowes, who we know is one of the canonical five. She was the fourth victim.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is DNA on this, and they have attempted to match that DNA to H.H. Holmes. Did not work. We think that the stains on the shawl may be blood or semen. And what they found, like I said, they don't match H.H. Holmes. They do match the descendants of Aaron Kaminsky, who's a Polish barber who immigrated to London and may have been one of the prime suspects at the time of the killings. Not because he's Polish. I just want that to be clear, because we do know there's a lot of xenophobia happening at the time.
Yeah.
The problem was that he heard voices and hallucinated. We still might be having a syphilis attack here, if we're clear. In 1891, he got so dysregulated and started threatening violence with a knife that they did send him to an asylum for a period of time. However, one should be cautioned of using DNA from this far back.
Yeah.
But it can be heavily contaminated, and it's unknown if it's related to the murder or to a sex act, if she was a sex worker, or a relationship, she was in a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
We have no idea. Maybe he cut himself while cutting her hair. Who knows, right? That's the problem with using this kind of forensic evidence this far out of late. At any rate, that is the story of Jack the Ripper. And we probably could do another 20 episodes if I wanted to deep dive into each of the weird ass theories.
Yep.
But not today.
But you know, it's such a fascinating thing for whatever reason. You know, it's interesting that it somehow caught the public attention so much compared to, I mean, because like just when you mention it, like the other murders in that area, I mean, there are a bunch of horrible things that happened around then. You know, it's kind of interesting that this, you know, just the press blew up and it became a thing and became this kind of worldwide well-known phenomena, you know. I mean, it's horrifying, but, you know, why this one, why that time? It just seems to kind of be the perfect storm of media having blown up, and I don't know, but...
And the amount of unrest, I think, had a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
And it was used as a moral judgment against the women living in this area at the time, I think, was the real reason it blew up.
Yeah.
Because you've got tons of women that are becoming very independent during this period of times. This is what H.H. Holmes preyed on.
Yeah.
Is that all the young women that were so independent, they were going down to Chicago for the first time by themselves. And they were gone for weeks at a time and people didn't hear from them and living in these houses, right?
Yeah.
And women are first starting to get quite a bit of agency during this period of time, actually.
Yeah.
So this would have been right before the suffragette movement in the 20s. I mean, we're only looking at 20 years before that. That's really, well, so it would have been 40 years total before that, right?
Yeah.
That's when you're really starting to see that mobilization. So it's probably a little bit of a cultural, like, pushback against women out of the home for the first times.
Yep, I can see that.
Yeah. And that is my theory on why Jack the Ripper became so interesting, is it was a sign to keep your girls at home or marry them off quicker.
Yep.
Because I believe misogyny is a real thing.
Yeah, and everybody loves a cautionary tale sort of thing of, you know, just, you know, I mean, it even makes me think of watching the movie Chicago when everybody's all obsessed with, you know, the jazz making people, you know, it's.
The jazz made them drink and, you know, kill their husbands.
Yeah, exactly. So.
Yeah.
But no, it's a, you know, fascinating stuff. It's always kind of interesting to hear about it. And yeah, it's just kind of still everywhere. I mean, more
There'll
so
probably
than
be a new book out in a month, man.
Yeah.
Well, especially because I think the H.H. Holmes movie, The Devil in the White City, isn't that supposed to be coming out soon?
I don't know. I knew that they were making one, but I had no idea if it had already come out or was coming out or what its deal is. But yeah.
I would assume that that'll reignite a whole bunch of H.H. Holmes and Jack the Ripper nonsense.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But no. Well, cool. Well, thanks for the topic and our 2 weeks of interesting stuff. So thank you, everybody, for listening to us. You know, as always, rate, subscribe, review, tell your friends about our podcast, and we'll see you all next week. Bye,
folks.